Thank you, sir. Evening, everybody. I'm Ross, but I'm an alcoholic. They gave me a 4-hour tape. I don't know if really you, after a meeting, tell me that it should have been on. I don't know why I'm putting this down here. It really makes no difference what I'm going to do, how long I'm going to talk, but that's the way it goes. At least I'm looking at something every once in a while. My sobriety date's January 9th, 1985, and that was a God-given sobriety date. It was nothing to do with me. I couldn't stop drinking to save my life. As a matter of fact, a couple times I'd even try to take my life because of drinking. That's just the truth of the matter. I don't know if I was born an alcoholic or not, but I know when I took that first, I remember taking that first drink, an alcoholic was born. That's the truth. My first recollection of drinking has been told to me by my parents, or my actual parents that I haven't seen for years and years. When I was 5 years old, I went downstairs too early for Christmas, and I got in those packages that my daddy got for his Christmas presents, which was fifths of Seagram 7, and I polished off as much as a 5-year-old could do, and then I passed out. And they showed these pictures of me sitting there underneath the tree with the bottle in my hand, passed out, and they showed those to friends and family for years. And told that story for even longer when they didn't have the pictures. I don't remember that. I don't remember. The first time I remember taking a drink, I was 8 or 9 years old. We lived in the projects, a part of South Baltimore. We had to go across the tracks to get to the wrong side of the tracks, how poor we were. So that's the way it was. And we lived in a projects, and the heater in the house wasn't keeping me and my brother warm, and we got enough guts in the middle of the night to go over and tell our parents that we were cold and we needed to be warm. And the kind of parents they were, they welcomed us into their bed. Looking back at it, they probably knew that their body heat would keep us a little bit warmer than just our little body heat would keep us warmer. And being the parents that they were, they did not have to move from the bed to get a flat bottle of Seagram 7. I don't know if it was a pint or a half pint, just know it was a flat bottle. And they gave me a drink. And it warmed me from the bottom of my toes to the top of my head. And it was wonderful. And they gave me another one. And that one did twice as good as the first one. And then I asked for another one, and they said no. And then my first alcoholic was in it. I knew they were keeping it all for themselves. I knew. Of course, when you're 8 or 9 years old, you don't become a daily drinker just like that. Off I went. I have not seen those real parents since I was 11 or 12 years old. I started growing up in foster homes. That's just the way it was. It's nothing good, nothing bad. If you want to match bad stories with bad stories, I'll do it after the meeting. I'll tell you my fifth step if it's going to help you one iota of a bit. As I've had the pleasure of telling parts of my stories to other people that help them out with problems that I've had when I was a youngster. But doesn't serve me any good up here. The only thing I used to do is just make you feel sorry for me so I get what I want. Oh, you done that too? Few of us in this room have done that. But anyhow, I went through high, because of the way I grew up, I didn't go to school for a whole year. I got left behind 1 year because I moved 7 times. And so when I got to high school and things like that, I was like one of the oldest kids in the high school, and I was very popular in high school. Because in Maryland, you couldn't buy booze when you're 21, until you're 21. But in D.C., you could buy at 18, and I was 18 and 19, and I was in high school. And I'd run over to D.C. every Friday and supply the whole high school with booze. I was very popular in high school. I was the man. I had a good time. Good time. Booze was a good time to me. We used to go to cake parties and have a ball. Just have a ball with cake parties all the time. You know, $1, $2, all you could drink. It was amazing. Just a ball. And there just wasn't enough of them, so I learned how to do them. That's one of those things. You know, if there's not enough of them, do some more. And there wasn't enough for me, so I did some more. And I'm going to probably tell my age. I'm 56 now, but I used to have to sit there and sneak into the school, type out the information on a steno sheet, and take it over to a mimeograph machine and mimeograph 300 or 400 copies of the flyer off to where this cake party was going to be. I mean, I'm good. That's all I got to say is I'm good. And that's what I did, you know. And we, that's, you know, we, and I'd sit around, and when it was getting over with, I'd be one of the guys sitting around going, float, 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 float. When you take those last couple of pulls on that, and the cake floats. Now, I don't know if there was anybody else around that cake sitting there saying, oh, when it floated, what, saying whether this or not, but I know I said it to myself. Now where am I going to get my next drink? When it floated. You know. It kind of makes me qualified for this program, and I'm like 18, 19, not worried about it. Went to college because I always wanted to become a school teacher. I'd like to sit here and tell you how I became a school teacher. Not my story. My story is I went to college. I went to college, and I felt the way I do when I get into strange places and the strange things I didn't feel as good as. I had a full ride. All I had to do was go teach school for 4 years, and I would have given a full ride scholarship. And all I did was drink because I was so scared. I learned that gin and Budweiser make a wonderful Boilermaker. That's all I remember. I don't know why they put 8 o'clock classes on the schedule. I'm never going to make them. But they did, and I signed up for them because I was dumb and I was a freshman. You don't sign up for 8 o'clock classes. And I had the choice to stay on academic probation in college and stay in school. But something came up December 1st. I think some of you other guys are older. Remember this? Called the draft. My number came up number 7. It's the only lottery I've ever come close to winning in my life. So I sat there and I had a decision to make. I said, well, okay, I can sit here and, you know, charge forward and do the best I can and buckle down to college. Or I can sit here and go to they had the GI Bill back to go in the Army for a few years. And come out and go to college on a GI Bill, which paid me to go to college. I said, well, that sounds like a better idea than this. I'm not doing too hot right now. So I chose Plan B, which seems like the easier way to me. I don't know anything about the Army, but they give you a battery of tests when you go in the Army. That's another thing I'm good at. Good at taking tests. Lying and taking tests. Good at both of those. But I was good at taking tests, so I took this battery of tests in the Army. And they sit there and say, well, gee, look at all these scores you've got. You're a smart fella. We're going to send you to West Point Prep School. And if you go through West Point Prep School and pass, we'll put you in West Point. You graduate from West Point, you become an officer and gentleman in the United States Army. I said, sign me up. No problem at all. So that's what I did. I went off to basic training, Fort Dix, New Jersey. And 6 weeks, some people in the platoon got thirsty. My old habit kicked in, ding, ding, out to Wrightsville I went, and I got all the booze I could carry, all the beer I could carry back to the barracks and get it in there, and me and my little platoon had a whole weekend where we just partied all weekend long, got drunker and Cootie Brown, all of us that were drinking anyhow, and we had a ball. Unfortunately, we got raided sometime Sunday morning, and they found 76 cans of beer in my wall locker and 2 of them in my hand. I already knew about the morning drink at that time, so it wasn't nothing unusual for me to be sitting there drinking at 7 or 8 or 9 in the morning if I had a bad night before. That's just the way it was. But the guy that was my company commander there at basic training was a West Point grad, and he didn't think that was a good idea to send me to West Point Prep School. So in lieu of disciplinary action, in other words, an easier soft way, he says, I would like you to revoke your orders and take your second choice of military occupational specialties. Or I will give you an Article 15, which is disciplinary action, which means they will probably take away you going to West Point Prep School. Anyhow, your choice. Easier, softer way, I pick column B. And off I went to my second military occupational specialty. And that's how come I became a military policeman. Have I told you yet that the rules apply to you in this world and they do not apply to me? And they give me a gun to enforce them, which really wasn't too smart. And that's what I did. I wasn't a very good military policeman. I just wasn't very good at it all. But when they got me at that military police, I went through advanced individual training, and I finished third in my whole battalion. I mean, it was quite a few. It was like 1,000 of us. And I finished like third. And I like to tell you, it's because I was hardworking and diligent. It's not because I had the answers to all the tests is why I did it. And while I was going through with Army Reserves and National Guard who did not want to go to Vietnam, who had all the answers to the tests and were quite happy getting 80s and 90s, you know, so they wouldn't rock the boat. But me, I got hundreds. And that's the way I got to whatever number 3 was in the battalion. And just about everybody in their company that was an active duty person went to Vietnam. I went later, but I didn't go at that time. And I got to go to Presidio, San Francisco, California. And if you don't know where Presidio, San Francisco, California is, I'll tell you. You've seen the Golden Gate Bridge, you've seen Presidio. Presidio's on one side, Fort Baker, Fort Cronkite's on the other, and they're both controlled by the Presidio. And that's where I was. And it's a beautiful place to, and it's a Harvey Wallbangers. They invented them. They know how to do them. They're wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. And I went out there, and they put me in the best squad, or in the best platoon, in the best company in that military police battalion. And they thought they had this real hot guy, as I got all these high scores, and was doing all this stuff. And all they got was a budding alcoholic. And from the time I got there, from being there, the only thing they let me do was in 18 months, the only thing that they let me do was drive the relief bus back and forth. And it was nothing that they caught me at. It was things that they heard. It was nothing that they could prove. I didn't have any disciplinary actions or anything like that. It was just kind of like, but they couldn't prove it. They couldn't prove that they wanted this one radio tower guarded or something like that, especially during the hours of darkness, so they sent the military policeman up there to guard it. And we'd call in everything every hour and say it was fine. Now, most guys would go up there, and they didn't like the job, and it was all alone up there for 4 hours, and they really didn't like it. I said, send me up there for 8. I really don't care. And they would send it. You had to get to wear your little fatigues. You didn't have to shine your boots or anything. That was right up my alley. Less work, same pay. Right in the front line. And so that's what I did. I went up there and did that. But see, and I'd say, just send me, leave me alone. I'll be up there for the 8 hours. And that's what they would do. Unfortunately, I would drive into this 7-Eleven that was on the way over there, and at 7-Eleven had Spignana wine. Wine's not familiar on this coast, but on that coast, it didn't find a grape. It never saw a grape unless it went through the produce section on the way to get into the place. It never saw a grape, and it was $1.79 a half a gallon. Ah, it's good stuff. And that was my 8-hour tour. That was my 8-hour tour of duty, and that's up there I went and call in every hour. I guess somebody found out about that. And then there was this other thing that me and one or two of my other partners used to do. They used to, over on the main post over at Presidio, they have this little beach there, right there on the bay. And you're not supposed to be on the beach at night. You're not supposed to have a fire. And you're not supposed to have green leafy vegetable substance or alcoholic beverages on that beach. And being the good military policeman I was, I made sure that you weren't supposed to do that. So we would go over there and we would bust these people. And we'd give them plan A or plan B. And plan A was, okay, we see that you have green leafy vegetable substance. We can take it, haul you down to the Provost Marshal's office, we can hold you there till the San Francisco City Police come and lock you up. Or plan B. You can let me or my partner dispose of it in that great big green bay out there. And we'll escort you to the back gate of the post. They always chose plan B. And of course, plan when they did that, they gave it to either me or my partner, and we would palm it and look like we were shaking it into the bay, and we would put it in their nice military police suit and tie in their pocket, and then escort them to the back of the gate. And about 4 o'clock in the morning, we and my partner would be asking the emergency check in about front, which was highly necessary at that time. And they heard about those things, but they never could prove them. But they, you know, they still busted me, took, you know, never let me do MP duties and all that stuff. I did, like I said, I did go to Vietnam for a year. You learn to live one day at a time there. That's truth of it. I did exactly 12 months to the day there. And most of the time I did it, we did 12-hour days. We worked 12-hour days most of the time. And fortunately, they had booze. We could get booze. And I drank just about every night when I got off duty. And that's what we did. Came back. Got out of the Army, got a job, working construction, became a construction foreman. Did pretty good. Then a recession hit back in 75 or 76, something like that, real bad recession. And they said, well, if you got a job at the company by February 1st, you'll have a job, you know, all the way through the recession. And if you don't, you know, hopefully you'll be formed. The longer you last, the faster you'll be rehired back. I got pink slip last week in January. Of course, that hurt my ego. I built up a little bit of something. I don't think I was drinking every day, but I was partying every weekend all the time that I could. I was probably close to drinking every day, at least something. But if not, you know, it wasn't no big deal that I wasn't. But I had a car and I had a motorcycle and I had a little money in the bank. And I said, well, heck with this. I will make my fortune in Las Vegas. So I sold my car and I sold my motorcycle. And I got on a plane and I went to Las Vegas to live on my wits. And that's what I tried to do. I went out there. I remember Friday night getting there. I remember the sun coming up Saturday morning. I don't remember anything else until sometime in the afternoon Monday, when I woke up at the Four Queens Hotel in downtown Las Vegas. And I got there, I had $4,800 with me. And when I woke up in the bed, I had $8,400, and I can remember the numbers because they're reversible. That is God doing for me what I could not do for myself. I wish he would do that a couple more times for a couple more weekends. But but I went out and I did things that made sure that, you know, I could live in Las Vegas for a while. I leased an apartment, a furnished apartment, at least a car with the money I had. I made out a budget to where I'd spend this much a week for so not a long time. And that's what I stuck with, or tried to stick with. But I was drinking, and they give you free drinks out there. And it's hard to drink and play poker and win, or play any of those games out there and win sober, let alone getting drunk all the time. And I got some roommates because of that. Need a little extra money coming in. Got a couple roommates. About 9 months later, it was obvious that I was going to go flat busted again. I had very little money in the bank. I said, okay, what can I do now? I needed a steady job or a job. It was still a recession going on. Las Vegas is not a recession proof, put it that way. I mean, that's vacations and stuff is one of the first things that gets off during a recession, and they weren't hiring people out there. I said, well, what's next? Well, you know, back in the Army. I said, okay, I'll go back in the Army. I signed up to go back in the Army, and I told everybody, okay, I'm going to make one last run to try to make some more money here in Las Vegas, or I'm going back in the Army. They threw me a goodbye party. They knew I wasn't going to make it. They knew I had no chance at all. I didn't look at it. At that time, I just thought they were being nice. But looking back at it, they knew I wasn't going to make it out there. I was not going to make more money in Las Vegas or anything unless I got real, real lucky. And I didn't get real, real lucky. So I had my goodbye party, and I went back into the Army. And I guess I knew that I had to get on the E6 list to stay in the Army and do 20 years. Because that's what my goal was when I got there. To stay in and have a career in the Army. And that's what I wanted to do. So that's, you know, what I aimed out to do. So I kind of slowed down on my drinking. And let's just say I stopped. They had beer in the barracks by that time. And any time I got the heebie-jeebies, 2 or 3 in the morning or whatever, I could run downstairs, pop 50 cents in the machine, hit the button, find a beer or two, and I was off and ready. I was okay. And I'd be all right. But I slowed down, and I soldiered the best that I could soldier for 18 months. And I got on that E6 list. And when I got on that E6 list, after that, it was like taking the foot off the brake and putting it on the gas. And never see anything else. Never. Gone. And that's the way it was for me. I got on the E6 list. Gone. They sent me over to Korea for a year. Best kept secret in the Army is Korea. A tour in Korea. A wonderful time. Especially when they make you, when you're a staff sergeant or military police. And one of your jobs is to make sure that people do not take contraband off the post. So I have my good military police officers make sure you don't take your Johnny Walker Red or your Bacardi Light Rum out of the Class 6 store down into the village. And they would collect it all, and they'd have the soldiers' names and all this stuff on it, and they would turn it into Sergeant Brown. Well, Sergeant Brown would sit there and call their first sergeant or their company commander, tell them, you discipline these soldiers. They've been trying to take contraband. There was one fifth of Johnny Walker, or one fifth of this, or one fifth of that, or whatever it was. And I'm sending you over the report, and I'm writing on the report that I destroyed it. I send a copy of the report over to their company commander. I take one copy and put it in the file. I take the booze and I put it in my Jeep. Nobody checking my Jeep going out the gate. I'm a military policeman. I can't pee on my name, baby. I'm going downtown and we're going to party. And I'd sell my stuff on their stuff on the black market, my stuff on the black market. And I was having a good year in Korea. I came back richer than I went. Let it go that way. And that was the rules apply to you. They don't apply to me. And that comes, I don't know where I got that concept. Maybe it was the upbringing that I had when I was a child. I have no earthly idea. But that's the truth of how I live. And it didn't make no difference whether it was on an emotional basis, a spiritual basis, legal basis, any kind of basis. I want what I wanted when I wanted it, and it didn't make any difference if I hurt you or I didn't. That's two things that was wrong with me since I can remember being wrong with me. I don't care about other people. And I really, really don't think I have a good approach to what's right and wrong. I still don't. I have a skewed perspective of it. If I want to do it, it's right. I don't care what gets in the way. If I want to do it, it's right. And I really don't care a whole lot about other people. It's a trying task to do it today. But I've learned that this is the best way to live. Really have. Really have. I drank more, I drunk more, got out of the Army, met and fell in love with a woman down here in Richmond as they sent me to a security school down at Bellwood. And her name was Susan Bell. I called her the Southern Belle. We were great drinking partners. And I got out of the Army because I thought we could make it a permanent relationship. And we were good on weekends. Monday through Friday, we couldn't deal with each other at all. And that's the truth. And I should have saw that coming, or I should have seen that it wasn't going to work. But my alcoholism was so far advanced, I had those rogue's colored glasses on. I couldn't see anything but what I wanted to see. And so I got out of the Army, and we lived together for about 18 months or so. I got a job when I was down here, a nice state job. And when I was a military policeman and anybody pulled me over when I was on post and I was drinking, I saw that it was Sergeant Brown. They would take me back to the barracks and they'd let me sleep it off. Or they'd drive my car back to the barracks and tell me not to drive no more that night. And that's what I would do so I wouldn't get into trouble. Unfortunately, Chesterfield County and the city of Richmond and Rico County are not, they don't care if I was an ex-military policeman or that I was working for the Department of Correction. They go put me in jail. And that's what they did. And I used to get to see Judge Shelton on a frequent basis. When I mean frequent basis, it means when I walk into a courtroom, he says, "Hello, Ross." Okay? That is not good when you're going into a courtroom and the judge knows you by first name. But back then, they would reduce everything, change everything. If you had a good lawyer, I mean, DUIs became hit and runs. DUIs became reckless driving. DUIs became blah, 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 blah. Whatever they were, they became reduced. And I had about reduced as many as they were going to reduce. And they caught me one more time. And this time it was going to be, I had a wonderful deal for my record. I was going to get a $500 fine, all but $250 suspended, a 10-day suspended license, restricted license for a year, and then I had to go to VASAP. That was it. And this was like walking and talking to Judge Shelton on a first-name basis. And that's a pretty good deal. And I was taking that deal. And I went to court, and I sat there and smiled, and I guess I wasn't too first, second, or third, or tenth on the docket or anything like that. I guess I went in there at 9, and I guess he got to me about 11. But he was giving people time and big fines, and I'm going, yeah, Judge, give it to them, baby. Man, knock it out. Yeah, give them people 30 days, weekends, holidays. Yeah, take their money. Go ahead, Judge. Yeah, take that driver's license. 2 years. That's it. Don't hurt me a bit, kid. I got my stuff in the bag. And now I got this deal between the Commonwealth attorney and my attorney. I got it. I'm hip, slick, and cool. And then all of a sudden, it was my turn to go up there. And he sat there and he had a piece of paper like this. And he said, oh, it wasn't like this. It was a thick pile about that thing. All the printouts of all the trash I'd done and everything. And he says, I have in front of me your record, Mr. Brown. And I also have agreement between your Commonwealth attorney and your attorney about how we're disposed of your case. I'm going to set this aside for a minute. Yeah, I know. Heart attack. Exactly what I did. I go, what? I said, yeah, you know, instantly you know when it's time to straighten up. Woo, this is time to straighten up. Ross Brown, attention. He got my full attention in that black robe. I'm like, Judge, good looking. Great guy. Can I shine your car? Do something. And it seemed like forever before he responded, but it was probably only a couple seconds or a couple minutes. It doesn't really matter. And he looked at me and he says, because you pleaded guilty in my court, I'm sitting there saying, this guy is going for the jugular. He says, I can give you up to 12 months. I think I'm mistaken, whatever the highest amount of fine was, I think it was $10,000. And a $10,000 fine, or both, because you pleaded guilty to a DUI in my court. And then he's quiet for a little while longer. It seemed like even twice as long as the first time. He says, this is exactly what I'll do if you don't follow each and one of these instructions that have been worked out between the Commonwealth attorney and your attorney. Because if you come back before me in this court and have violated any provisions of this, that's what I will do. And I believe him, folks. I honestly believe him. They took my driver's license for 10 days right then and there. I wrote him a $250 check to cover that fine. Of course, my car was out in the parking lot. I had to drive it home. Had to, you know, can't stay there, can't get a tow, can't have somebody come with me to drive me home. Even though I knew I wasn't going to have a driver's license when I came out, the deal was already done. But I drove home. And when I got home, I started drinking. Of course, drinking, I wasn't supposed to be drinking, so that was number one off the list. I wasn't supposed to be driving, that's two off the list. And I started polishing off booze. And I got as drunk as I possibly could, and I sat there and thought for a minute, and I said, you know something, I think Judge Shelton has overreacted to this situation. But if you had a bad day like that, booze is the only answer I had. That's what I did. That's what I got. I drank. And I'm sitting there thinking, now how am I going to cover that $250 hot check I just paid for the coach? That's the way. That's every day. It's Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, any day that ends with a Y, I'm drinking and I'm trying to figure out how to deal with life on Lifetime. That's the truth of it. I kept on drinking. I didn't know what else to do. But I did go through VASAP. I'll tell you one little short story about my drinking. I worked 10 days on and 5 days off, and I loved the 5 days off. The 10 days on were miserable, but they all just ran together. This is what I would do. I'd get up about 2 o'clock in the afternoon at 3 o'clock. I worked a 4 to 12 shift. So I'd get up at 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I would go to work. I get off at midnight, start drinking, drink till I pass out, till I get up to 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Same thing for 10 days. I did that once, on a Tuesday, and went to work what I thought was the next day, which ended up being Thursday, and everybody was asking me, where was I yesterday? And I'm sitting here, what? It's Wednesday, right? No, it's Thursday. I'm going, what happened? I have no idea where Wednesday went. No clue. Days were so the same. Still don't know where that Wednesday's gone. Don't know really a whole bunch about 1976, if you want to get truthful about it. But, you know, that's the way they were just the same every day. And I don't remember what I did on that Wednesday. Having a clue. I know I didn't call in for work to work, and they were mad at me that I didn't show up. And I paid the consequences on Thursday. That's the way it was. Finally, I went to this VASAP lady, put it off as long as I could. Got a little bit honest with her. Told her about a third of how much I drank, a third of how much I spend on drinking, and a third of how much time I thought about drinking. And she said that made me a class 3 alcoholic. I didn't know up until a little while back, somebody looked it up on the computer and gave me the computer printout on what a class 3 alcoholic is. Class 3 alcoholic is, last stages, Options of treatment for being locked up. Those are the options. And that's where I was, because that's what they accused me. And they said, we'd like you to go to treatment. And I said, hey, okay, I'll go to treatment, because I remember when I was watching those commercials for the treatment centers back, they were very popular back in the 80s and 90s. And went to the street, and it showed this nice, beautiful building, and the sunset and the swimming pool and a little pond out front and everything like that. And said, if you think you have a problem with drinking and drugging, we think we can help you. And I sat there and said, oh, isn't it great that people have a problem? Have some place to go. One more down the ass. And I always thought it was nice. I said, well, yeah, I'll go to that. So I got that, went to treatment. Of course, I put that off. That was October. I put it off as far as I could. January, because I had such a bitchy social schedule over the holiday season, There was nobody calling me, and I wasn't calling anybody, and nobody wanted to see me, and I didn't want to see anybody else. I just wanted to be left alone to drink like I needed to drink for another 2 months. I was supposed to go, I think it was on the 18th of January. January 9th, 1985, like I said, it was my sobriety day. 4 o'clock in the morning. No other night, I got off at 12, just like I usually do. Started drinking, finished off about 3/4 of a fifth of bourbon, and I felt as sober as I do right now. I knew it wasn't going to work. I could have sat there and drank a gallon, and it wouldn't work. Because I've had nights where I drank that much, and I knew it wasn't going to work. And I said the drunkard's prayer. I said, God help me. And I haven't had a drink since. I like to tell you that I knew what I was doing, but I didn't. I had no clue of what I was doing. I went back to, I know something that changed. I guess it's the grace of God. That's all I can call it. You can call it anything you want to. The next day I went back to work and I signed up for overtime for the next 9 days. I worked in a maximum security prison. They don't serve booze there, and it's really hard to get. I could have probably got it if I wanted to, but really hard to get. But I wanted to stay sober for those 9 days till I got the treatment. So I worked 16-hour shifts, so I only had to worry about the 8 hours that I got off. First 2 or 3 days, 4 days maybe even, of not drinking, I couldn't eat. Doesn't look like I ever missed a meal, does it, folks? I couldn't eat those couple 3 days. I could drink coffee and tea and get those down. I think Diet Pepsi also. That's about all I could get down and stay on my stomach, and I was just like that. I had to write my name on law books, and it was always like that. I worked those 16 hours, and I'd get off 8 hours. I couldn't sleep. Walk the halls, watch TV, get up, walk the halls, watch TV. Up 20, 22 hours a day until you just exhaust and pass out. And then get a couple hours sleep and go back and do it again. And then 9 days later, I went to treatment down there at St. John's, Goochland County. It's a pretty good treatment center. I have nothing against treatment centers. I got there, they asked me the silliest questions I've ever been asked in my life. One of them was the last time I had a drink, and I told them 9 days or 9 days ago. And they were kind of surprised that it was 9 days ago. Because I guess you're supposed to have your last drink in the parking lot like everybody else in the place had. But not me. I'm 9 days clean. I'm 9 days sober. So I go in there, and they also said, do you have any booze in your car, Mr. Brown? I'm going, do I have any booze in my car? The question should be, in the last 10 years, have I not had any booze in my car? I could tell you the exact dates and times. Because I always had a spare, had a bottle underneath the passenger seat. The lone wolf, nobody was running around with me. If you drove in my car, the first thing I did was I opened up your side and I pulled out the bottle underneath my the passenger seat. And I always had a spare by the spare. And I knew when I got the spare by the spare, it was time. The next time the ABC store opened, I also had to go and make sure that it was loaded up so it never run out. And that's the kind of way I drank. I went through treatment, did 28 days in the treatment program. I like to say the great things about treatment program, and I'll tell you what it is. They brought me to AA meetings. Okay? They brought me to AA meetings. And they did educate me on the disease of alcoholism. They did do that. But I wasn't sure that I was an alcoholic. Okay? They did not prove that to me. The people and members of, I caught the disease of alcoholism in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Okay? I do not have a drinking problem. I do not have an alcohol problem. Because if I had an alcohol problem, January 9th, 1985, the problem would have went away because I haven't drank. I got the disease of alcoholism, which is self-centered to the max. That's me. That's why I got a 4-hour tank. But I did start the process of recovery. They told me to get a sponsor. I got a sponsor. The guy tried to fire me once. Well, actually, he did fire me once, but I got the job back. And he was the only person that I was out there, and all the time that I was drinking, had said, if you think you have a problem, we can get you help. And then I found out why. I got my job back at another place, but I got my job back. And lo and behold, when they took us out to these AA meetings, there he was in those AA meetings. And I'm like, and there's another thing I learned today. You can't turn down a legitimate AA request. I can use things to my advantage all the time. So, legitimate AA request, you're going to be my sponsor. Legit. No problem. He can't say no. Deal's made. Whether he wants it or not, he's got me. So I go ask Frank to be my sponsor. I'm not going to hear a word he has to say about it. Frank, you're going to be my sponsor. And he says, oh, yeah, I'd like to get together with you. And he says, why not can you do that? I said, well, I got another 2 weeks to do in this nut hut. But as soon as I get out, we'll get together and talk. And sure enough, I got out. He says, well, these are the meetings he goes to. And I went to the one of the meetings, and I met him. And this is what he required of me. He said, go 3 meetings a week. I recommend you go to a speaker meeting, a discussion meeting, and some kind of literature meeting, a big book meeting, or 12-on-12 meeting. And I'd like to meet you at one of those meetings every week. And we started from there. I like to say I was a good sponsee. I'm a great guy that I am. But I did it my way. I did as little as I possibly could. The IRS audited me in the first 5 months I was sober, about 5th month I was sober. They audited me. I'm going, excuse me, why are they doing this? I'm not on my 9th step yet. I haven't even done 4 yet. They said I'd done 4 in the treatment center, but looking back at it, 4 was really 1, the way I had written it. And of course, I was going to meetings. I was doing the best I can. I did 67 meetings in 90 days. They said do 90 and 90. That's as many as I could. I went to aftercare because the counselor forced me to go to aftercare. He was going to take me back before Judge Shelton. So I did the 16 weeks of aftercare. Mm-hmm. Done that. All that stuff. Judge Shelton's out of the way. No more of that. And I'm sitting there 8.5 months stone cold sober. And I want to drink so bad, I'm going to die. I want to die. And I'm sitting there saying, what the heck is wrong? And I went to 4 meetings in a row on the 4-step. I don't suggest you wait around till that happens, folks, but that's what happened to me. And after the 4th meeting, I sat there and said, oh, I think I'll do my 4-step. And I ran home and I did 5 4-step, which ended up being 16 pages of legal pad front and back of the greatest work I've ever done in my life. Unfortunately, it was a first step. It had nothing to do with a fourth step. I found that out when I ran over and showed it to Frank. I got my fourth step, Frank, coming over. When? Now. He says, I ain't got time now, about 3 hours. I said, 3 hours, let me do it. I run over there, and he didn't get through the first page in the hat and says, well, this is a great first step. I ain't got nothing to do with a four-step program about Alcoholics Anonymous. And he's telling the truth. It's everything on his pieces of paper was every lousy thing I had done in the, out there drinking and living, whether I was drunk or sober, and that I wanted to be forgiven for. My way. That's my program. One step, out. Forgive me, and I'm okay. And that's not the program. And he says, go back, and I think he said the pages. I can't quote them. Still to this day, I can't quote them. He can. And he says, go through the columns and write about your resentments, write about your fears, write about the harms you've done under in your sickness inventory. If you have any problems, give me a call. I will help you. Just helping, eh? New, 8.5 months. First word of the first steps, we. I'm sitting there still trying to do it with me. Doesn't work. Didn't work for me. So I went back and did the best I could with the fourth step, with the columns and the resentments and everything like that. 3.5 pages, legal pad. Peeked over at 5. I said, I won't go back to Frank and mess it up. And it says, tell God, yourself, another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs. And I told God. And I changed my story when I was telling myself. Because I got to be better than that. Or I got to be worse than that. Or whatever. I got to change that. It's not what I want. I want to be better. But the thing about it was, it's the closest I was going to get to the truth. So I told God, and I told myself, and I ran over there and told Frank the exact same story 3 different times. Okay? It was as close as I was going to get to getting right with the world about me. Went home, did the hour, had a marvelous experience within that hour saying, you know, I'm not that good at being that bad. But if I sit here and do the rest of this program, it seems like I'm going to get a little bit better than what I used to be. Because I just did not want to be what I used to be anymore. And that's the truth of it. I wanted to be just a little bit better. And believe me, that's all I got, was a little bit better. And a little bit better, a little bit better. And so I went over there and we did Frank, and then Frank, we went over and did the rest of the steps together. 2.5 years sober. I'm hip, slick, and cool in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm sponsoring at least one guy. One. And he's not doing too good, but I think I'm doing okay. But I need more spiritual growth. And Frank has got 18 months more than me, but he really doesn't have enough. That's the way I looked at it. He might have been fine if I didn't change or anything like that. But I needed more. And so I went to a guy that had 38 years of continuous sobriety. I was 37 years old. I wanted what he had. Don't know how I was going to do that math to get it to fit in there, but I wanted what he had, all that 38 years of sobriety. And I said, Sarge, I want you to be my sponsor. And he said, I'll be your sponsor if you stop your whining. Well, you know, hip, slick, and cool guy that's hunting for a spiritual experience, spiritual growth here. What's he saying that to me for? But I know the answer. Yes. The answer was yes. I gave him the answer, yes. Fine. I said, if you take me book through the book and do the book like the old timers, you know, used to do in the old time. He said, no problem, Wednesday night. Wednesday night after a meeting, over Sarge's house. Boom, 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 through the book. 10 weeks later, happy, joyous, and free. People have been asking me to be their sponsor ever since, at least one a year. And they go through the book and do the book. 3 or 4 a year. Then I'm Spino, too. If you don't know what Spino means, it's sponsor in name only. They use me like the cross to a vampire. Ross is my sponsor. Don't ask me no more questions. Of course, they will never ask Ross the questions. Give him the call. Go through the book. Say hello. Or meet me in a meeting. But I'm their sponsor. But the other guys, a great pleasure to be around. I've got people that are 16 years sober, 15, 14, 10, all the way down. Picked up a new guy this year. He's doing pretty good. Pretty good. Hope he makes it through. Don't know if he's going to or not. Some dropped this time, some dropped that time. But he's doing well as he stands right now. The thing about it is, every time I go through that book with somebody else, something comes out about me I got to do. I was 8 years sober. Some guy was sitting there saying he had to pay back his college loan payments and stuff like that. And I'm saying, Frostburg State, $255 I owe. And it just came out of the blue. I'm like, 8 years, you know. And then I'm like, no, that was 20-some years. You know, the interest is going to be on. You call them. Make the best deal you can. Write the checks. That's what you do. That's what you do if you want to clean the sober. Stay sober. It's been a marvelous trip. I don't know how God has blessed me so much in such a short period of time. He always answers his prayers, yes, no, and not right now. And I always like the yeses better. I seldom like the no's. And really have a difficult time with the not right now's. But the thing about it is, every one of them's worked out in God's good time. You know? I was sitting there and, you know, you get sober, you stay sober for a few years. I wanted to go back to college, get promoted at work, become a big-time, big-job guy, right? Supposed to. That's what hey, teaches. Go do something good. So I sit there and decide to go back to college. I go first class, I go to college. Not for me. Teaching me something I already know. You know? Don't really care. Sit there and run back to my sponsor and say, this doesn't feel right. It's not good. I don't feel right about it. What should I do? He says, well, pray about it. Okay. If you don't feel good about it, quit. He says, and figure out what you're supposed to do with the time and the money. Okay? I said, okay. I'll pray about it. I'll pray about it. My gut's telling me this ain't for me. So I go, this ain't for me. I'm out of here. Out of the class. See you later. I go on down the road. And I'm sitting in a little cubicle doing paperwork, classifying inmates. Main headquarters, Department of Corrections. Grade 6 job. Go on about doing my A business and all that stuff. Start taking that money that I would have put in college and put it into deferred compensation. So when 55, 59, 60 or whatever, before the stock market went, I put the money into the deferred comp, and the stock market went, so did my deferred comp go, and my wife got to retire before, and because she needed to, because of that, we draw $1,000 a month off of that, because we did that. I sat there in that cubicle as a grade 6. I got regraded to a grade 8 about 4 years later. I got upgraded to a grade 9 about 2 years after that. They regraded the whole system and made the category 9s, 9s through 11s. So I ended up being a grade pay, getting paid the same as a pay grade 11 at the end of my tour with the Department of Corrections. I didn't move out of the cubicle. Didn't go back to college. Just listened to my gut. All because I asked the questions and did the instructions that AA taught me. And not only that, I got to retire early. Because the job I had was going to be eliminated. Well, not my job because I had 23 years in. But another guy's job was going to be eliminated. And he couldn't go to the out into the field to where another job was because he had a handicap, he had a wheelchair. He could go out to prison. And they offered me a retirement package to give me 6 more years, and I went and bought 2 years of military time back, and I retired for 31 years with the state. And what does that happen? Just for sitting, I'm still sitting in the same cubicle. I packed up the same little cubicle. Out the door I go, and I'm retired. You know? Amazing. You know? Not right now, Ross. You know, don't go to college now. Do something better with the money. I know. And then those things happen. Where else can that happen? Who else does that happen to? I know. It doesn't happen to other people. Not as frequently as it does to people in Alcoholics Anonymous that are working the program of recovery. When I was 10 years sober, I had a free year. I knew exactly what I was doing and why I was doing it. And it was a great year of recovery, the greatest year of recovery in my life. I was helping people to the max of my ability. I started taping little conferences and things that people asked me to tape because my sponsor gave me all his tape equipment. He used to help tape down at Blackstone. And he gave me all his tape and equipment. I said, why are you giving it to me? He says, you're the only one that will use it. I said, okay, thanks. And I've been taping like that. Like he said, me and my wife taped an online conference. 400 people that think I'm the greatest thing in the whole world. It's a great conference. I keep on telling them I'm the bane of your existence. Without me, you're pretty much. But it was a good conference for once. I mean, they who do have some ones that aren't as good as this one. They had some good speakers. So this was nice. It was a good conference. They deserve the accolades for that. My wife's been going to Al-Anon since I was 2.5 years sober. I say I ran her in there. She says she ran herself in there. Our marriage probably wouldn't have lasted if it hadn't. Like I said, stuff with the deferred comp and all that stuff. But really, all that money stuff and everything like that really doesn't mean a hill of beans. It's what I do every single day that make me feel good inside or feel good as. I get up in the morning, I read the third step prayer and the seventh step prayer. I read a vision for you on page 140 and 164. I read about acceptance. And my book is 449, and the new edition is another page. I read about resentments on page 522. And I also pick up a couple other meditationals and readings that are not conference approved, but I read them anyhow. And I end off by reading the 11th step from where it says, the 11th step suggests the squiggly lines. I think that's probably an important part of stuff when it's squiggly lines. And I read to the end of that chapter on the 11th step. And I meditate for a few minutes or as long as I can. I turn my will and life care of God to the best of my ability every single morning. And I try to sit there and do that 11th step every single night to the best of my ability. Whereas I'm selfish, angry, you know, resentful. Whatever. And learn how to live better and better each and every day. I could not have planned. If I wanted to come here, I'll tell you, I would learn how to drink and not get in any more trouble. That's exactly what I wanted to learn. How to drink and not get in any more trouble. That's what I wanted when I got here. And I've gotten so, so much more. I learned how to live a spiritual way of life, which is behind my wildest dreams. Each and every year gets better. I don't know what's next for me, but the only thing I can honestly say, or honestly tell you, that it's going to get better and the best years of my life lie ahead of me, as long as I keep on practicing these principles in my life. I thank you for listening. It's been a nice time.